the UCR Podcast.
We've got a rare one today, folks. Legendary guitarist Ritchie Blackmore, known for his time in Deep Purple and Rainbow, among others, joins us on the podcast to look back at the 50th anniversary of Rainbow's Rising album, which came out this week in 1976. And we're going to talk about a bunch of other things with Ritchie as well. There is a Rainbow box set that hit the shelves recently called Temple of the King, 1975 to 1976, a 9-disc box set revisiting his first two albums with the band. In addition to 1975's Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow, and the group's second album, Rising, released in 1976, the set also features three complete live concerts from the period. An additional disc of rarities rounds out the box, which includes a great book that has an essay with Blackmore's recollections of the time period. It is the first, and this is good news, of what is planned to be a number of anthologies of Blackmore's work. And the guitarist has remained active, as you might know, most often making music with his wife, Candace Knight, with their group, Blackmore's Night. Blackmore's Night had to cancel a short run of U.S. tour dates last fall after the guitarist developed health issues only two shows into the run. He tells us now that the severe vertigo issues that caused him to come off the road were, quote, the worst thing I've ever been involved with. Thankfully, as you'll hear in today's conversation, Ritchie is doing better, and he had a lot to talk about and discuss in this interview, which happened in an interesting way. We did it virtually. I sent Ritchie my questions, and he sent me his answers, and Ritchie was very thoughtful with the way he addressed the various topics, and there's even a bit of sarcasm and humor that shines through at times. I'm glad we got to do this, and I appreciate Ritchie taking the time to talk about all this stuff. The new Rainbow Temple of the King box set is available wherever you get your music. If you're a fellow fan of Blackmore's work, I think you will really appreciate what the folks have done putting this set together. Blackmoresnight.com is the official website for Ritchie and Candace, where you'll find all of their latest updates, as well as merchandise, information on charities that they've partnered with, and more. It is Matt Wardlaw. If this is your first time listening to the UCR podcast, please follow us so that you will receive future episodes of the podcast, and visit store.ultimateclassicrock.com to find a wide selection of music for your collection, including plenty of Rainbow and Deep Purple albums. Make sure that you use my discount code WARDLAW15 to get 15% off your order. So go and make yourself a nice stack. Now, here's our conversation with the legendary Ritchie Blackmore. Hey, Ritchie, thank you so much for doing this, man. It is greatly appreciated. To start, how are you feeling? Because fans, of course, have been concerned about your well-being following your recent health struggles.
I woke up one morning when we were on tour, and I had what is called vertigo. I don't recommend it to anybody. It was the worst thing I've ever been involved with. I've had heart problems, gout problems, and pain, but vertigo is the worst thing I've ever been involved with. You're very dizzy to the point of where you have no control over any part of your body, and you just fall down, basically. And you can't even think properly. It's almost like a stroke, but you can speak and you can understand, which is different to a stroke. And I had that in a hotel, and I was taken off to the local hospital, where they kind of gave me the cure for vertigo. It's called epi movement. You have to move your head to the left and right, and you have to take antihistamines, believe it or not. Take antihistamines, and taking those antihistamines is like taking something for seasickness. It's like seasickness when you're at sea. It was like I was in a fishing boat at sea in the biggest gale you could imagine, and I had to grab hold of anything I could find, like a chair, to stop from falling down. That scared the hell out of me. So we canceled the tour after that, came home, and then it hit me again 2 days later, and it's not something I recommend for anybody to have. Because I always thought when people talk about vertigo, they're talking about, oh, you feel a little bit dizzy, but it's not that. You think your whole world is ending right there. Every day now, I'm looking to the left and right and straining my neck because that's where it's all coming from. But it's a bit of a mystery. I've found that at my age, being 150, that, you know, it's time to kind of pull back on touring. I do not like traveling anymore. I love playing to anybody on any stage, but to get to that place, sometimes the traveling makes me sick. When I was a child and I would go with my mother on the Royal Blue to Bristol in England, to where most of our relatives lived, I would always throw up. I would be the age of 9 or 10. And maybe that is what made me have a phobia about traveling. Now I seem to have a phobia almost about traveling too far, leaving the comfort zone of one's home. It's a very strange element to have. And so consequently, I want to do our next shows. I want to be on stage. I want to play. I'm still playing all the time. I want to play within the radius of like 30 miles or 40 miles on the island. We live on Long Island. And I don't want to go hundreds of miles because that seems to upset my equilibrium. And it's funny how I had forgotten how I reacted when I was a child, when I was 9 and 10, how I would always throw up when I was traveling. So there we have a kind of, therein lies a mystery that I do like to be at home. So what I'm trying to do now is do dates that are closer to home.
Well, I want to dig into this new Rainbow box set. What do you remember feeling as you started to work on putting the band together? And how do you think you'd grown as a result of your time in Deep Purple? And how do you think that informed what you wanted to do next, which ends up being Rainbow?
When I left Deep Purple, I just felt that the band wasn't pulling as a musical venture. It became a committee. It was like if there were some answers to be had, there were five different answers. And I got a little bit tired of the committee meetings, a bit like what John Cleese said about Monty Python. I basically thought, I'm going to get four other musicians where I don't need to have a committee meeting and just get on with playing the music. I needed some fresh blood, a bit like a vampire. I'm not a vampire. I don't think I am. But it has been said, and but I don't believe it. I just wanted a change. I felt that it was a stalemate. Everybody was into different things, and I always remember the manager turning around to the band and saying, "Okay, guys, let's work out the tour for the next year." And it was in January, so straight away it was okay. What about January the 25th, starting in blah, blah, blah? And somebody would speak up. Oh, I can't make that. I have a wedding to attend to. Okay, forget that. February, let's do February. Let's start in February. And then someone would pipe up. Oh, I can't make that. I'm going on holiday in February. And this went on, believe it or not, until about June or July. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. Everybody's got somewhere else to go or something else to do. What's happening with the band? Are we a band anymore? Or are we just going on holiday and going to certain weddings? So that was just one of the reasons that I left. I also wanted to do this song called Black Sheep of the Family, which I thought was a great song that we should do. Whereas one of the members of the band said, I don't want to do that song. We didn't write it, so we won't get writing credits. I thought that was kind of ridiculous. And so I did it with Ronnie Dio, and we did it in an afternoon. And I really liked Ronnie's voice, and we worked so quickly together. There was no committee meetings. He wasn't going on holiday or getting married or anything else, so things seemed to be going along quite quickly. And I said, I can't like this. And that's when I decided to leave.
From your point of view, how were you further evolving with these first two Rainbow albums? I would imagine that each one represents a memorable chapter for you personally as far as what was accomplished and at the same time learned.
I don't believe in evolving. Number one, I don't really understand the word. And I was just uncomfortable. So it was time to move on and do other things. I'd been in Purple, I think, for 7 years. And I think I got the feeling that we'd done everything we could do in our type of music. I did notice a lot of egos coming and going, so that was tiring. I just wanted to play music, not have any egos. The biggest ego of all of them was me. And I was kind of disgusted with myself at the time. So I thought, I want to move on. I want to be away from myself. I found that difficult. But David Copperfield helped me out. He said, I can make you move from yourself and be in the audience at the same time that you're on stage. And I said, okay, carry on. So that's where I went with that. I went to Las Vegas, joined David Copperfield's crew. He taught me exactly how to be in two places at once. And I paid him handsomely for what he did. And that was it.
How do you think you and Ronnie challenged each other as writers and creatives?
Yes, we had a couple of old ceremonial swords. So we went out the back and we fought it out around his house. That's how we challenged each other. But realistically, challenging never came into the equation. We always got along very easily. It was very easy to write with Ronnie because he was had been a trumpeter in an orchestra, so he was very musical. So I would sometimes at rehearsals, he would say to me, what are you hearing in this? I would go up to him, and as we were all playing as a band, I would kind of hum or whisper in his ear what I thought maybe the idea. And he instantly got the idea of where I was going. And that's how we made most of our music. He was very quick to write lyrics, although I never really understood some of the lyrics. And I would ask him, what's Man on the Silver Mountain? What's that? And he'd go, I don't really know. Just something I thought of as a spur of the moment, which, you know, I think everybody has their own silver mountain that they can pretend to have. So sometimes lyrics don't have to make perfect sense.
Okay, what did you appreciate about what Ronnie brought to your music?
Working with Ronnie was very easy. When we first put down a couple of songs on a recorder that we had, he wasn't singing the usual heavy metal song. What he was singing, it was like a Renaissance 1500 kind of melody to a lot of the ideas I had, which I was very impressed with his interpretations. He was obviously a very clever guy, and it never took him more than 10 minutes to come up with something as far as the melody goes. Although sometimes I would give him a melody in which he would use, but he was very quick on the uptake. I think Ronnie, his own way, it's kind of strange because I think he would spend more time watching baseball than he would actually writing a song, because he could write a song so quickly that he would write it in 10 minutes and then go back to his baseball, which he loved. So that's, it was very easy to write with him. And there was so much continuity. Immediately, he seemed to know what page I was on when I was trying to come up with certain ideas. And I hadn't really had that. Took me towards the end with Purple. There was a lot of discontent and a lot of scattered thinking, and very difficult to get everybody together in the same room. So it was such a pleasure just to be able to sit with a guitar, play something, and the man knew exactly where I was going with it. And I really didn't have to do much coaxing or helping him, because he basically helped himself. He was a magical guy.
If you would, share your memories about Man on the Silver Mountain as far as where it started and how it evolved to what we eventually heard as fans on the debut Rainbow album.
Man on the Silver Mountain. Of course, I had the riff and the progression and the keys and everything worked out. And I just went to Ron. He said, "What are you hearing on this song?" And I kind of did my usual, which was, as I was playing the very heavy riff with the band, it would be very loud. And I would kind of hum to him what I thought should be sung to a point. And he immediately picked up what I was trying to hum. And Man on a Silver Mountain, it was interesting, because I said to him, "What's the lyrics about?" He said, "Well, it's Man on a Silver Mountain." And I said, "Well, what man and what mountain?" And he said, "I don't know. It was just something that came into my head at the time," which to me was very refreshing. He didn't have to explain what it was about. And to this day, I don't think anybody cares what it's about, or they have their own interpretation of what a silver mountain is. Because I did say, "Well, where is this mountain that you're talking about?" He said, "Oh, it's nowhere. It's just in my mind." He was obviously thinking about a silver mountain at that time and injected that into the song. But I suppose everybody can read into it whatever they think.
Another song, "Still I'm Sad," such an underrated tune from the Yardbirds catalog. Talk about how you and Rainbow approached recording your own version.
"Still I'm Sad" was a song that I had the Yardbirds doing. And I just loved the melody, which was reminded me of a very old kind of tune going back. You're talking like in the 4th, 5th century. And I love anything that goes back to the older times. And I'm a sucker for especially Renaissance music. So I had always had it in the back of my head to do as an instrumental. We just had, I think, 10 minutes spare, and I put it down. It wasn't something I had actually worked on very long. It was just a tune that I really loved. And sometimes it works that way. Most of the stuff I did when I was playing heavy rock wasn't worked out. I just made it up on the spur of the moment. Consequently, we'd be in the studio to 6 in the morning, because I'd be still kind of trying to come up with the idea, because I hadn't practiced or worked it out beforehand. "Still I'm Sad" was just a very nice tune. But I like the progression, the way it goes from an E minor and then it goes to a G major. That's your typical progressions from the old times of Renaissance and medieval times.
Overall, what are some of the moments that really stick with you about recording that first Rainbow album?
Doing the first Rainbow album was tricky in a way, because I had nothing worked out, hardly. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where I was going. And at the time, there was a lot of different people involved with the management side of things. So everything was very tricky. So I was just glad that I could put down, I think it was 10 or 11 songs. And I think a couple of the songs were good, and I think a couple of the songs were a bit weak. But I did it, I think, in about 3 weeks. So it was something that I had not thought through properly. It was just, I just played whatever came to mind at the time. And I didn't quite know what style I even wanted to play. That's why some of it's very melodic and some of it's very heavy. I was torn in between the two type of styles. If you believe that, you'll believe anything.
After that first album, you brought in Jimmy, Tony, and Cozy to work with you and Ronnie. As an outsider, it seems like the shows that the band played in the last half of 1975 were an important driver that influenced material and ideas for the eventual Rising album in a pretty interesting way. How did that time period and everything that was happening feed and kind of further fuel the creativity that you were already feeling?
Well, musically, that period was, I was becoming comfortable in my own skin the second time we approached stuff for Rainbow. I knew more or less where I was going, which was more heavy, but yet with an accent on melody. So as opposed to the first record, which I really didn't have much of an idea what I wanted to do. The second one, I was much more adamant about what I personally wanted to get across, especially with things like Stargazer and heavier songs. And Ronnie was coming into his own with his tone and his way of thinking. Because, like I said before, we were both heavily into light kind of music in the beginning. But then when Rising came along, we were turning into a very heavy rock band, which I didn't mind at all, because that's one of the styles I love to play. And obviously, Ronnie was on board with that style too. And then Cozy was always a heavy hitter, so he was the right guy for us at the time. So we went our merry way, which was down the hard rock road, and I was feeling much more comfortable with being in a studio without being in a studio with Purple. This is the second record that I made with other members, other musicians. So I was getting kind of used to being in the studio and feeling more comfortable than I was in the beginning.
What are your memories of Kill the King coming together while you were out there touring for Rising?
Kill the King was something that I just came up with the usual riff, not the usual riff, but a usual riff construction, gave it to Ronnie, and we just threw it together. It's not one of my favorite tracks, and but I'm happy that other people liked it. But it was not a favorite track for me. I thought it was, you know, pretty average, you know, but it was quite exciting. So we cut the point across.
The live shows on this box set are really, really special to have. You had gotten to do your share of improvisation with Deep Purple, but looking at the variety night to night with the three shows here, it really feels like you had a blank canvas with infinite possibilities each night that you stepped on the stage. What do you appreciate now about how each of the guys in this band pushed you in the live setting? It feels like it would have been very energizing to play off of any of these guys, Ronnie and Cozy for sure.
On stage, which is my favorite place to be. And I do like to improvise, and I do like to play certain songs different ways, which confuses everybody. But I do like playing games and almost playing one song differently every night so that it keeps people on their toes, including myself. I would say that what drove a lot of the nights, I know what it drove me, was it drove my anger. I seemed to be very angry on stage. That music that we were playing, I kind of opened up that kind of corridor of thought, that it was anger that we were expressing to the audience, and the audience was picking up on it because I could tell that people in the audience, they were angry too. Although they loved it, it was an escape valve for everybody's anger. So a lot of Rainbow songs relied on this angry interpretation, which the guy who did the 9-to-5 job in the audience with the denim jacket, he was angry too. So we were all in unison and sympathetic to each other, that we were all hard done by people and how angry you can be. And it's just a way of getting that anger out, which I did. Every time I came off stage, you know, it was a great release for me. But Cozy was pretty angry. I was angry. And Ronnie was angry. We're three angry guys, you know, kind of pushing to express our music that we felt wasn't being heard enough on the radio, because the radio was playing all smaltzy kind of stuff, especially in England. It was quite interesting how they would not really go near our stuff. We were considered too heavy and too loud and too aggressive, but we enjoyed it. And of course, we were playing to packed houses, so I assumed there was a lot of angry people out there that enjoyed our anger.
Well, I would like to close with a bit of Deep Purple lore, and it's the story of how one particular night in San Antonio, Texas, on August 28th, 1970, you reportedly had a bad reaction to a flu shot and were too ill to play, so the band enlisted Christopher Cross, who would become known for his own hit singles years later, to fill in for you on guitar. And I wondered what memories you have of that.
That particular time, I had obviously, it must have had a virus or something, because I had a canker sore in my mouth under my tongue. So I couldn't eat. I couldn't speak. So I was miserable about that. I wasn't happy about being on tour in America. I loved Europe, and America was so far apart, and the places that we played in, I had no idea where I was. I wasn't in my comfort zone, and I kind of missed England. That particular night, I think it came to a climax. I remember being very miserable, and I was walking down the corridor with John Lord to go to the show, and then I just kind of felt very dizzy, grabbed hold of John, and he kept me walking, and then I fell down, and they took me to the hospital. They didn't know what it was. I think it was just pure misery. And they kept giving me shots in the hospital. They didn't. The doctors would say, "Where's the pain? What do you feel?" I go, "I just don't know. I'm just so miserable." And it was interesting that they said the week before, apparently they'd had Keith Richard was in for a similar kind of experience, and which I kind of wondered about. So I just stayed in the hotel being miserable, and they went on and did the show with, I think his name is Christopher Cross or something, some other guitarist, and luckily they played, because it's a terrible feeling when you're sick on the road and you let everybody down. You're letting the audience down, the crew down, the band down. So nobody wants to be sick on the road, but it does happen a lot. I can get quite depressed, and I was very depressed at the time being in America and knowing that I'd be there for 3 months before I got back to England. And of course, now I live in America, but I'm living in a totally different situation. I have family here, and I live on Long Island, which is very similar to England. And I didn't like, when I lived in California, I lived in Hollywood. That was all tinsel, and everybody had a psychiatrist, and there were no carpenters or electricians. It was very strange. It was like being in the Twilight Zone for me. And I did 3 years of living there, and then that was enough for me. I thought, if I get to New York or that area, Connecticut, I can be 6 hours, 7 hours away from England. Whereas when you're in California, in those days, it was 12 hours. And that to me, with all the palm trees and being 72 degrees every day, got me pretty depressed. So I'm glad that I now live in an island that gets snow one day and the sunshine the next, and then it rains the next. I'm happy about that. Not seeing the seasons in California was very bizarre. That didn't suit me at all. But I know it suits a lot of people if they're into, I suppose, partying and yucking it up. But to me, every day it was the same. And that bothered me. And it was like being on a film set. Every day you'd wake up and you'd look out and it would be exactly the same. There's an old saying, when it's 105 in New York, it's 72 degrees in California. And when it's at minus 30 in New York, it's 72 degrees in California. And in New York, there's probably 10 million interesting people. And in California, there's 72. But I suppose I shouldn't tell that. It's supposed to be a joke. I don't want the people to take it. There were some great times I had. But, I mean, it's not for me. Palm trees are not my favorite trees. I like oak trees, the English oak tree. And trees like that. And fields, which there weren't too many of those things in Hollywood. There was lots of people selling T-shirts and lots of advertising. So not for me.
Well, I can understand that. There he is. There is Richie Blackmore, everyone. What a pleasure it was to have this conversation with Richie. Don't forget, as I mentioned at the beginning of today's podcast, there is a rainbow box set that came out called Temple of the King, 1975 to 1976. It's a 9-disc box set revisiting his first two albums with the band, Richie Blackmore's Rainbow, and of course the second album, Rising, which turned 50 this week. The set also features 3 complete live concerts from the period, an additional disc of rarities rounds out the box, which includes a book that has an essay with Blackmore's recollections of that time period. So hunt that down wherever you get your music, and you're going to dig it, I promise. We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.